on shortwave, AM, FM, and the internet. This is PCJ. Yeah! It's now time for the Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Perrone.
Oh, no!
Hello, everyone. Hello, everywhere. Welcome again to another edition of the International Happy Station. At the moment, I am sort of walking down some mountain slope. Well, not really a mountain, more of a hill, trying not to fall. It's a little rocky, and I'm walking towards a certain area, but I'm not going to tell you where I am. To find out, you will have to tune in to next week's show. Now, hopefully, the sound that you will hear right now will not give it away. Because if it does, then I've sort of spoiled the surprise. The only thing I will tell you is that right now, I can see a large amount of rocks and some plants and a very large rock, which is probably at least 50 meters high. Let me point the microphone a little bit to the north of me and see if you can hear anything different. Yes, the sound of water. Now, if that didn't give it away, I don't know what will. Anyway, for this week's edition of the International Happy Station, I decided, because I'm on vacation, that we would present a special program. And also because I'm busy preparing next week's show, which is completely recorded where I am right now, which, like I said, you will have to tune in to find out exactly where that is. So this week, we're going to be presenting a special program produced and presented by Jonathan Marks called A Tribute to Pete Myers.
On April 17th, 2009, my late friend and colleague Pete Myers would have been 70 years old. Sadly, he passed away on December 15th, 1998. Yet after exploring the sound archives, it seems like this talented storyteller is still very much alive. He had a truly extraordinary life, and what seems like an endless supply of personal stories and experiences. I help produce the following tribute programme called A Talent to Amuse, and I've decided to put it back on the internet to make sure that Pete's contribution to the world of great storytelling is never, never forgotten. His views on radio, for instance, are as though they were recorded yesterday.
Radio can still
leave a lot to the imagination. That was the beauty of radio. That's what I liked. You could go out there and you can conjure up pictures in people's minds without the pain that sometimes you see so much on television. Radio still has a lot to say. And radio has depth, it has character, it's theatre of the head, theatre of the imagination. And a lot of that still has to be explored. And people will give you time if you produce the goods.
And deliver the goods he did. First as a young broadcaster in Ghana, then for 11 years with the BBC as their star presenter with the African service, and finally for more than 22 years with us here at Radio Netherlands, giving us the benefit of his inspiring presence and shaking us up a bit as well. Pete was a consummate storyteller who'd mastered the art of scriptwriting and shaping sound during his years at the BBC. In the coming 45 minutes, we'll be focusing on that side of his great talent. He was born in Bangalore, India, in 1939, where he grew up with his parents and maternal grandparents. His grandmother in particular had a major influence on him. But here's the man himself.
Now, she was a woman of German origin whose family settled in India in the 19th century, in Madras. Music was second nature to her. She married an Englishman whose family also settled in South India at about the same time. And happily, music ran in his bloodline too. Grandpa used to play the banjo, and Granny, the piano. And this love for the piano was imparted to all her four children, and so always the house was filled with music. My mother, who had a preference for jazz and pop music, also managed to master the piano and the piano accordion. So, you see, I grew up with George Formby on the veranda, Mozart in the parlour, and Glenn Miller accordion serenading out of the bedrooms. Glorious India, which surrounded us and was then rushing on its way to independence, never musically seemed to penetrate that house. I must say, India and my roots was a voyage of discovery that was to occur decades later. So, you see, it was inevitable that I would be put to music.
So Pete studied the piano with his grandmother, hoping that one day he'd tour the world stages as a concert pianist. However,
subversion was at work in the shape of my mother, a wild, beautiful creature who, because of her stunning good looks and free spirit, was constantly surrounded by admirers. Because, you see, when mother hit the keyboard, it was party time. And she had this ability to listen to pianists like Charlie Coons or Earl Hines and then play just like the original. So when I'd finished butchering my Moonlight Sonata, we'd sit at the piano together, and she'd introduce me to what she called real music. Now, there was always a feud between mother and daughter as to who would control my musical taste. And in the end, mother won. And that introduced me to another powerful musical influence, jazz. And when it came to the jazz pianists, our all-time favorite, Errol Garner.
During those early years in India, he also had his first brief encounter with greatness.
When I was 6 years old, I had my very first brief encounter on a train in India. With my mother and my ayah, that's a nursemaid, we were making the long journey from Delhi to Madras. We were travelling first class, up in the front of the train. And travelling in third class at the back of that train was the father of India, Mahatma Gandhi. He always travelled third class. Whenever the train pulled into a station, a huge crowd of people would be waiting to catch a glimpse of the great soul. Well, at one of these stops, my mother drags me out of my comfortable compartment. We push our way through the crowd until finally we come within viewing distance of Gandhi. At six, I had no idea who this man was, except that he was very old, didn't seem to have a tooth in his head, and was smothered in a sea of well-wishers who all seemed to be attempting to get into his carriage. In the pandemonium, hysteria, sweat and confusion, our eyes met for one brief moment. And that was that. My mother now kept that memory alive by constantly reminding me that I had seen the Mahatma. As I grew older and understood the man's achievements, his place in history, I wondered if I had learned some moral lesson from that brief visual encounter with a saint. And the answer today is yes. And it's this. If ever you travel by train in India and can afford it, forget Gandhi. Always go first class.
And more than 50 years after that meeting, Pete produced a special programme on the Mahatma, commemorating the 50th anniversary of his violent death. Ironically, it was to be Pete's last production, and this time there was no irreverent punchline.
Bringing Mahatma Gandhi out of the museums and history books is no easy task for modern-day Indians. In the 50 years since his death, industrial India has changed beyond recognition. And though Gandhi's statue, bust, or picture can be seen in thousands of towns and cities, he's also something of a forgotten prophet, a dead saint to be worshipped rather than followed. 15 years ago, there was an upsurge of universal interest in the Mahatma when the film Gandhi was released. But after its makers picked up innumerable awards, interest waned, and the little man in his homespun dhoti returned to the mists of history and mythology. His epic life has been abundantly documented. At the last count, there have been something like 550 biographies of the man. His own writings can fill a library. Now, it's not my intention to present a biography of his life, as I have always been guided by the words of Pandit Nehru, who said, "No man can truly write a real life of Gandhi unless he's as big as Gandhi." What I have before me are images of the man as recollected by people who had intimate knowledge of him and shared in his quest for truth and freedom. They left their memories in a sound archive that's been sitting in our vault for decades. Hearing these voices from the past, and an occasional one from the present, only confirms what an admirer said on his death 50 years ago, that Gandhi made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We're not done yet with Grandma Mehta.
In the late 40s, after witnessing the agonizing partition of India, surviving the bloodbath in Calcutta, the family decided to do what Mr. Gandhi had been saying for years, and quit India. With my parents, I travelled to the Middle East, where my father's side of the family had roots, and to the West Indies, Trinidad, where I discovered the earthy joys of Calypso. Finally, it was decided to send me to Britain, where my grandparents had settled, and it isn't a period I remember with too much joy. You see, Britain in those post-war 50s was a grey and dreary island, and the only bright spots were the occasional trip to London to see a show and the weekly visit to the cinema with Mehta. Of course, when it came to the movies, there was a whole range of magicians and magic moments, but there's one I will always associate with Mehta. Now, while my parents were gallivanting around the globe, their marriage slowly disintegrating, I was being guided through my formative years by this fantastic lady, who was enormous. She was huge. She had the widest hips in Christendom, a terrific sense of humor, and this passion for the cinema, which she handed on to me. Well, one movie was to have a crazy effect on both of us. And when it rained, as it usually did in England, we'd have a little routine we developed. We'd grab our umbrellas, dash into the back garden, and entertain the neighbors, who'd be peeking from behind their curtain-shrouded windows and probably mumbling things like, "Bloody crazy foreigners." But who cared about the neighbors? When it rained, these two foreigners were doing our thing, and no prizes for guessing who we were emulating.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I walk down the lane with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain. Dancing in the rain, yeah, 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 yeah. I'm happy again. I'm singing and dancing in the rain. singing in the rain.
Gene Kelly's most enduring film moment, and one I'll ever associate with the most rewarding female influence on my life, Grandma.
This passion for music and the cinema that was instilled in him by his grandmother was later often used by Pete to great effect in the shows he produced, never more successfully than in a four-part series on the Hollywood musical. One of the programmes dealt with ghost singers, artists who lent their voices to stars who couldn't handle the singing part. Meticulous research and his engaging storytelling skills produced this little gem.
The most renowned Hollywood dubbing artist was Marnie Nixon. Born in California, trained as a classical singer, she had perfect pitch, and as a young woman sang the female lead in three of the most popular film musicals ever made. That famous voice first came to our attention in 1956, dubbing for Deborah Carr in The King and I, and performing them with a perfect English accent.
Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid. While shivering in my shoes, I strike a careless pose and whistle a happy tune and no one ever knows I'm afraid.
A year later, Miss Carr was asked to sing a song in the movie An Affair to Remember, and again Miss Nixon obliged. Then in 61 came the blockbuster, and if you thought Natalie Wood sang her songs in West Side Story, and then think again. Yes, it's our heroine, this time with a perfect Puerto Rican accent.
I feel pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and gay, and I pity any girl who's in me today. I feel charming, oh so charming. It's alarming how charming I feel, and so pretty that I hardly can believe I'm real. See the pretty girl in that mirror there. Who can that attractive girl be? Such a pretty face, such a pretty dress, such a pretty smile, such a pretty me. I feel stunning and entrancing, feel like running and dancing for joy, for I love my pretty wonderful boy.
And once more a year later, Miss Wood was asked to star in another musical, Gypsy, and again Miss Nixon obliged. All too often, stars were allowed to use their own singing voices, and in 1957, Audrey Hepburn did all her own vocals in Funny Face. The film was so stylish, it managed to survive the experience.
I could cry salty tears. Where have I been all these years? Is it fun? Or should I run? How long has this been going on?
Fortunately, not too long. 7 years later, in 64, Miss Hepburn gets the lead in My Fair Lady. Clearly, with that slender voice, she could never handle the songs. So guess who's brought in? Correct. And here's Miss Nixon with a perfect Cockney accent.
A room somewhere far away from the cold night air, with one enormous chair. How wouldn't it be lovely? Lots of chocolate for me to eat, lots of cow making lots of eat, warm face, warm hands, warm feet. How wouldn't it be lovely?
The lovely Marnie Nixon, the ghostess with the mostess.
In the 1960s and early 70s, Pete became the voice of the BBC in Africa. He presented the immensely popular daily programme Good Morning Africa. And on Sundays, there was a special show featuring a star guest.
Coming to you from London on the BBC's World Service, it's PM. ¶¶ Africa, the World, this Sunday with Pete Myers.
The guest could be an actress like Glenda Jackson, a singer such as Bing Crosby, a composer like Stephen Sondheim, or any other celebrity who might have something to say. And they might be introduced something like this.
16 years ago, when I was a puberty pimple student at college in Rochester, Kent, and very active on the Students' Entertainment Committee, one of my chores was to organize the students' annual outing to a West End theatre, an event somewhat coloured by my predecessor, who had a marked preference for Shakespeare. For years, the students would be bussed to London for the day and bored out of their angry young minds by the eternal bard and infernal actors. The only thing they looked forward to was the titanic booze-up we used to have on the bus on the way back after the show. Now, the year I inherited the job, 1956, I decided to break with tradition and offer my fellow students something even Shakespeare would have appreciated: sex. It had arrived in the West End that summer in the delicious shape of an exciting 18-year-old from Cardiff. They billed her as the Tigress of Cardiff Bay, and with a voice that shattered the rafters and a song that outraged the nation, she was the West End's biggest attraction in a variety review called Talk of the Town. Well, I took my fellow students to that show, and to this day they remain in my debt. For we caught the very first public performances of a British singer who has matured into one of the most flamboyant international entertainers of our time. And my guest on PM today, Miss Shirley Bassey.
Who's got a match or strike him? Don't say it all depends. Who wants to help me burn my candle at both ends? Who's got a light he's hiding under a bushel, friends? Who wants to help me burn my candle at both ends? Possible it may not.
What followed was a scintillating conversation about poverty, racism, stardom, and acting. And then, with the temperamental Miss Bassey suitably relaxed, this curveball from Pete.
Can I ask a very candid comment? I mean, is there a bit of a tart in you as well? You know, there's a bit of bitchiness in you.
There must be, because all the parts I get sent to me, they're all about tarts, you know. Whores, you know. There must be a bit of tartiness. I mean, when I do Big Spender, I really feel like a tart. And I probably look like one. And I love it.
On another occasion, Swedish actress Ingrid Bergman was his guest. At one point, the conversation turned to Miss Bergman's role of Joan of Arc, the French peasant girl who in the 15th century led French troops to victory over the English and was burnt at the stake.
You know, I'll tell you a little story about Joan of Arc. That was, in fact, the very first film I ever saw you in when I was a young man, a kid.
Yeah.
And it had a tremendous effect on me, because after the burning at the stake scene, I don't know, it must have touched some spark in my psychology, but I was fascinated by you being burnt at the stake. And there was a young girl who lived in the next door, across the wall, and she used to have a lot of dolls.
Yeah.
And I stole about 7 of her dolls and burnt them at a stake. And in my imagination, each one of those dolls was you.
What did she say about that?
Well, she didn't know. She didn't know for quite some time. She just kept noticing that her dolls kept missing. She would leave them in the garden. Then finally, one afternoon, while I was in the blazing away, you see, with her last precious little doll, she looked over the wall and screamed and howled. And her mother came, and my parents had to pay for 7 dolls because of you.
Well, I hope you made 7 saints out of the dolls.
By 1974, Pete had left the BBC. Years of often doing 9 shows a week had left him drained. He was ready for a new adventure. And so he was off to Beirut, Lebanon, to manage a nightclub. Well, adventure he wanted, and adventure he got. Only months after he arrived in Beirut, a civil war broke out that was to last 15 years. By 1976, life in the divided city had become too dangerous, and he left. 18 years later, he returned to visit his old haunts, together with colleague Ginger De Silva. Standing in the street where he used to live, this crazy memory came flooding back.
I used to have fun here. I used to have fun. You see how big this building is? What, 7 stories? And the rooftop was interesting. Now, in my day, It used to be controlled by three factions. The top end of that street would be controlled by one faction, the middle by another faction, and the bottom by another faction. So I had to have passes to go through all three of these factions to get walked down my own street. And at night, the guys on the right hand of the street would start shooting at the guys on the bottom of the street. And they would just fire at each other for no reason at all, which was very horrifying because you never got any sleep all night. So I thought, well, I'm going to fix you guys. So I went up to the roof and I had two huge speakers and I screwed up my speakers right up on the roof. And I remember the piece of music I played at about 1 a.m. they started shooting at shadows. And I thought, oh God, another sleepless night, thanks to these idiots. So I went up there and I had a recording of William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast. I don't know if you've ever heard this piece of music. And it has the most glorious hallelujah. And at full blast at 1 a.m, suddenly from heaven came this great hallelujah blasting out from the rooftop, thanks to me. And it stopped them. They were so stunned. They looked up and they could hear music wafting from the skies, you know. And I quickly then dismantled my speakers, ran back down to the ground floor, you know, just in time when a guy came knocking and said, did you do that? I said, me? No, look, my speakers are here. But I gave them a bit of classical music in the war. You know, they needed it. And William Walton certainly gave us one, you know, one night apiece.
When Pete Myers joined Radio Netherlands in 1976, his first job was to give us a voice in Africa, and the Afro Scene program did just that. His next brief was to put Radio Netherlands on the map in Asia, and again he produced the goods, with shows like Mainstream Asia and Asia Scan. Now Pete sometimes referred to himself somewhat disparagingly as the king of trivia. Well, see what you think. The following excerpt is from a program he made in 1987 about Mother Teresa and her work for the poor.
Now, in my recent tour of the Asian subcontinent, one saw the face of poverty and hunger, and nowhere more so than in Calcutta, the largest city in India with a population of close to 10 million people. A city that appears to be drowning in a sea of humanity, and which tugs at your consciousness like the persistent hand of a begging child. It's a city of constant traffic jams, decaying buildings, trams, buses, communal taxis, overflowing with people. On the surface, it looks like the most inhuman city on Earth, suffocating, violent. And yet, it bursts with a vitality and spirit that forces every visitor to pause and admire man's incredible staying power under the most adverse conditions. And throughout the day and well into night, the city's symphony of car horns and chattering crowds shatters the Bengal air. In the very heart of Calcutta, on the Lower Circular Road, is the headquarters of the Missionaries of Charity. It's an unimposing convent known as the Mother House. The entrance is in a tiny alley, and to gain admittance, you simply pull a string that rings the doorbell. A barefoot nun, in a spotless white sari trimmed with a blue border, admits you into a tiny courtyard with cement benches. There's a banana tree in one corner, and somewhere in the upstairs chapel, you can hear the voices of the sisters and novices at choir practice. In a city that seems to have gone mad, this little courtyard is an oasis of peace, and the only shattering noise are the screeches of the crows that constantly protest from the rooftops. I had come to this convent not merely to meet a Nobel Peace Prize winner, or the Saint of Calcutta, as she is often referred to, but with a purpose. For 3 weeks, I had traveled the length and breadth of Pakistan and India, and wherever I went, I talked with experts, social workers, relief agency people, missionaries, government officials, about the poorest of the poor. And the overriding impression I got is that the children of God were just mere statistics. They were fed, given handouts, logged in some bureaucratic file, and probably forgotten. But you see, the scale of the problem is so vast that there was no time for anyone to deal with them as individuals. People with names, with problems, hopes, ambitions, just like you and me. But here, by some miracle, I was told, was a group of workers who made it their life's work to treat everyone they came into contact with love and respect.
But Pete also had a mad streak that was never far away.
Today on Asia Scan, a world exclusive, because since the beginning of this week, rumours have been reaching us here to the effect that a Yeti has not only been sighted in Nepal, but actually captured by a team of Indian mountaineers. The first time that the abominable snowman, as the Yeti is known, has been taken into captivity. Well, early this morning, I managed to track down the leader of the Indian team, Professor Ram Gopal, to their base camp at the foot of the K2 mountain. And there I spoke to him by phone about this exciting discovery. Professor Ram, how did you capture the Yeti?
We start the expedition, you see, about 1 month ago to go look for the Yeti. We go up in the Himalayas and we are making camp just on K2, just about 4 kilometers from K2 mountain. You know this one?
Yes.
Well, then we are camping there one night, and one night one of our Sherpa man, he come running down the hill, he say, Yeti coming, Yeti coming. And then we standing there, we see this big Yeti chasing him. So when my friend, I say, quick, come, and we get one big net, and we put it by the tent, and the Yeti is walking into the net. Very simple.
Is the Yeti wild?
My God, yes, he is very wild. He is livid. He is shaking everything in the cage over there. I don't know what we are going to do, how we are going to get him to Delhi.
Well, why?
He looks very angry.
Well, congratulations, Professor Ram, and thank you for talking to us. I'll leave you now to go off and feed the Yeti. What do you feed him on?
What? I don't know. Yesterday we gave him 2 Sherpas, but maybe today we'll have to cut back.
You're running out of Sherpas.
We're running out of Sherpas, I'm telling you.
Professor Ram Gopal, leader of the Indian expedition to K2, and that's a story I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about.
Peter's an Indian mountaineer with Mike Bullen as the interviewer. Many listeners were fooled by that spoof, but they should have looked at the date, April the 1st. With that deep, warm voice, Pete was often asked by colleagues to do jingles or promos for their shows. Being a bit of a ham actor, he usually obliged.
Next week, Media Network's new phase of computer experiments. That's November the 4th. You don't have to be a broadcaster to do this sort of thing.
Thanks, Sherlock.
Elementary, Watson, my dear.
Come on, my dear Watson.
During his 22 years with Radio Netherlands, Pete launched a whole series of new programmes, not only for Africa and Asia, but also for the rest of the world. There was Rembrandt Express, or 50 Plus, which made the point that life after 50 could still be fun. And there were groundbreaking items for international broadcasting on such taboo subjects as homosexuality, in the monthly Gay Front feature. But his biggest challenge came in 1992, when the management asked him to be the new host of Sunday's Happy Station programme. His brief was to drag this older show on shortwave into the 1990s and create a new and younger audience for the Sunday slot. He was given a free hand. Only the title had to stay.
Well, this is it. The very first show of the new season. I'm Pete Myers, and from this point on, I have the pleasure of being your Sunday host. And I must admit, you know, taking over a show that's only had two hosts in 64 years is a daunting experience. I mean, for four decades, the Happy Station was dominated by Eddie Starts, a man I never knew, but who made this program his whole life. He rattled his teacup, and he was kind, and he was charming and considerate, and had this image of being everybody's favorite uncle. And then in 1970, along came my old buddy Tom Meyer, and he imprinted his personality on the show for two decades. He could speak, well, 1,000 languages. He could sing. He loved animals, is kind-hearted, considerate, wonderful with grandmothers, and was all sweetness and light. Now, he was the nearest thing to Mary Poppins Radio Netherlands ever had, or will ever get. So, what do you get? Since 1928, you got 40 odd years with Happy and Pappy and your favorite uncle, and 20 odd years of Mary Poppins, and suddenly you tune in today, and you're confronted with a middle-aged neurotic with a big mouth, a gammy leg, and a sex life put on hold. Well, darlings, at long last, welcome to the real world, and spread the word. The Wicked Witch of the Lowlands has arrived. And yes, dears, I do have a credo, too. It's short, it's sweet, it's funky.
Hey, everybody, let's have some fun. You only live but once, and when you're dead, you're done. So let the good time roll. I say let the good time roll. I don't care if you're young or old. You ought to get together and let the good time roll out. Don't sit there mumbling, talking trash. If you want to have a ball, you got to go out and spend some cash. And let the good time roll now. I'm talking about the good times. Well, it makes no difference whether you're young or old. All you got to do is get together and let the good time roll out.
Some of the regular listeners must have been shocked out of their blue rinses and rocking chairs. But it worked. With a new audience for the Sunday slot, Happy Station was ready to be retired a few years later and replaced by programmes less burdened by tradition. The year before Pete took over the Happy Station show, he produced what was probably his most successful series, Great Balls of Fire. In nine programmes, he traced the emergence of rock and roll in the 1950s and featured the music that dominated jukeboxes and airwaves in North America and Europe in those pre-rock years.
Black performers who were extremely popular with white audiences and record buyers. People like Lena Horne, Billy Eckstine, Ella and Louie, and Sarah Vaughan. All of them had distinctive voices, but under the control of the major recording companies, their output was totally geared for white consumption. Now, personally, I find it repulsive to talk in terms of race, but the world of 1952 was extremely racially divided, particularly in the United States, where even music was segregated. Very little of this division was known to us in Europe, or that there existed a wealth of material marketed by little independent record companies for blacks only. It was known then as race music, and out of this reservoir would come rhythm and blues, soul, and rock and roll.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on, join me home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight.
The historic recording that officially launched the rock era in 1955, Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock. But it was not the first rock and roll song. That Agree or Disagree was cut in 1951 in Memphis, Tennessee, at a legendary little studio where Elvis Presley would record his first tracks. The Sun Recording Studio, run by Sam Phillips, a far-sighted white southerner who had a gift for recognizing and recording talent, black and white, that others would ignore. In March 1951, the studio got its first R&B number one, a rhythm and blues then being the market exclusively for black record buyers, with a recording that historians now acknowledge as the very first rock record. I ended last week's program with it, but then you didn't know that the band belonged to a 19-year-old named Ike Turner. He's on piano. Jackie Brenston, the sax player, did the vocal, and the song was about a popular car at the time known as the Rocket 88.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
The first rock and roll record from 1951. Apart from his passion for the cinema and music, Pete was also a keen reader. His preference was for biographies and books dealing with key periods in history, ranging from the reign of the Egyptian pharaohs to the slave trade and, of course, the Second World War. In 1994, on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy, France, he produced a special programme on that turning point in the war. And, as always, he managed to bring down the momentous event to human proportions by giving it a personal touch.
I am a child of the war. I was 5 years ill when D-Day took place. I was living in a country that was untouched by the ravages of war, India, far from the killing fields of Normandy and Europe. My father was a captain in the war, but he fought in the Burma campaign. My mother, who came from a military family, drove an army truck in Madras. I remember the truck. I remember the khaki uniforms my parents wore, and I remember the music that wafted from our tropical veranda, where my grandfather would listen to his shortwave radio and my mother would jitterbug to records played on a wind-up gramophone. I was never allowed to touch those records or play anywhere near that valuable equipment. But the music was always there, and it's remained with me ever since.
Buzzard took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzard tried to throw the monkey off of his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top."
The Andrews sisters, whose hairstyles my mother would religiously copy. Now, Mother had three brothers, Gerald, George, and Ernest. George, like my father, fought the war in Burma. Gerald was a teenager and was too young to join up. But Uncle Ernest was the warrior. Just before World War II broke out, he went to Britain and joined a regiment of the Signals Corps.
In 1940, he was one of the thousands who was whisked off the beaches of Dunkirk. In his will, he left me his diary of that incredible evacuation. On June the 6th, 1944, he returned to France. But we, in distant India, knew nothing of it till much, much later. But I remember that day, and I have a little scar on the bridge of my nose to prove it. On D-Day, you see, while playing, I fell down and injured my nose. I was taken to hospital for a couple of stitches and arrived home to find my grandfather jubilant and excited. On his shortwave radio, he had heard the news of the invasion. Mother said that Grandpa was elated. All day he yelled, "The Germans are finished, we've got them on the run," totally forgetting the fact that his wife, my grandmother, was German. I had a black eye and a scar, which Mother would refer to as my D-Day scar. My Uncle Ernest, the warrior, never kept a diary of his D-Day exploits, and when I questioned him about it, he remained strangely silent, as if the memory of that day was too painful to recall. All he would say is that war is a terrible, terrible thing, and that many of his comrades never returned from the shores of France. He spent the rest of his life attending reunions and visiting the old battlefields. And when he died 3 years ago, he only had one request regarding his funeral, and that was to hear this voice and this song as he marched away to eternity.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that my heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon. But I'll be seeing.
Dame Vera Lynn, who for Second World War veterans always remained the sweetheart of the forces. Pete will be sadly missed by his many fans throughout the world. And as for us, his colleagues, we'll always remember his inspiring presence, his wicked sense of humour, his generous help when we were struggling with a programme. And of course, the one piece of advice he always gave us, whatever you do, don't bore your listeners. He certainly lived up to his own rule. But what about Pete Myers himself? How would he like to be remembered?
As a fun person, as someone at least who gave pleasure in 40 years, rather than, you know, as someone who tried to be profound.
I believe in doing what I can, crying when I must, laughing when I choose. Hi-ho, if life were all, I would be lonely. But I believe that since my life began, the most I've had is just a talent to amuse. Hi-ho, if love were all,
A tribute to Pete Myers, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the International Happy Station Show. I've been your host, Keith Perron, well, at least for these little breaks. Tune in next week to find out exactly where we are coming from. And in the meantime, if you want to find out more about PCJ Media and the other shows that we have, do check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. So, on behalf of everyone that helped put this program together, including that of Jonathan Marks, this is Keith Perron saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Thank you.